Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the world economy right after this. You know, if you've got an income of $50,000, you're paying $7,650 a year in Social Security taxes. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of that $50,000 twice? Now, you know the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of $50,000 in Social Security tax. Then they make you pay 17% of that same $50,000 in income tax. And that means that you're paying 17% of that $7,650 twice. And that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from you and everyone else who pays that tax. What would you think if Sears, Penny's, or your credit card company charged you twice, like Social Security and the IRS does? I thought you'd think that was just kind of special. Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. And tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home study. And if you're online, you can go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Click on the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we were talking about The Privateer. The Privateer is published by William Buckler. Comes from Queensland, Australia. It's an international newsletter, published 26 issues a year, every other week. I rate it right up at the very top. It's $180 a year, Australian. I don't know what that is in U.S. funds. I can tell you this, it's worth every dollar. In fact, I suggest that every student that comes through my school subscribe to The Privateer and The Money Changer. Those two. Stay abreast of what's going on. These two guys are not advocating that you speculate and gamble in the stock and bond markets. They're telling you plainly, the world's economy is about to unravel. And when it does, the world isn't going to disappear. Germany didn't disappear after World War II. They lost the war. The Germans stayed right there, and they're right there to this day. But boy, were there some massive dislocations and changes that occurred in 1945, and that's about where we're headed. And you can subscribe right now. You can send a letter to Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, 4567, Australia. That's William A.M. Buckler, P.O. Box 2004, Noosa Heads, N-O-O-S-A-H-E-A-D-S, Queensland, 4567, Australia. The webpage, www.theprivateer.com. That's www.the, and there's a hyphen between the and privateer.com. Or you can go to the website, and then the email is capt@theprivateer.com. Remember that, capt@the-privateer.com. Well, the Aussies are dancing the plastic fantastic just like we are in the United States. And Australians are living in a world where tomorrow never comes, because when it does, it's today. And they must be driving the little Australian Reserve Bank batty, because the RBA has been screaming at the top of their lungs trying to convince Australians that going into debt at this rate, the debts are now over 150% of household disposable incomes. It's an all-time national record. And it's going to come to a very bad end. So the RBA has even raised their interest rates a number of times, but that hasn't worked either in the slightest, as is clear from the Reserve Bank's latest report, in which it sadly notes that the single month of June, Australians piled another 4% on their credit and charge cards. That's $12.4 billion in a nation of only 20 million people. Now, that's only two-thirds of the population of California, some of whom don't even have credit cards. And the Australians, that if you dare, If you annualize that, big as the June number was, it pales in comparison to the record monthly plastic meltdown that took place, as one could expect, last December when a huge $13.7 billion was piled on the cards. On a nationwide basis, Australia's credit expansion was running at an annualized rate of a full 18% over the first half of 2004. That's only a slight slowdown from the 21% rate of the last half of 2003. I guess the Australians figure that we might as well live it up because the end is near. Apparently, this actually happened in Sydney. Suddenly, a nice, everyday, middle-aged Aussie bloke grew a beard and was seen out on his lawn on his knees five times a day, pressing his head to the ground and mumbling incomprehensible words. The word spread, and finally some people showed up in those unmarked cars that Australians are learning to know so well to ask him some questions. Must look out for terrorism threats, don't you know? Well, 10 minutes later, they walked away, stopping two or three times to bend over or hold each other up in gales of laughter. Apparently, his explanation was that he had seen a news report to the federal parliament to the effect that the telephones of Australians are now being tapped at a 30 times higher rate than the phones in the United States. And that's where he got his idea. You see, his own phone had a very bad line when it worked at all. No matter what he tried, nobody had come around to fix it. So he figured that if he started behaving like a new Muslim convert, they would have to fix his phone line first before they could begin tapping it. And the ploy worked. We tips our lids to a true Aussie larrikin. We need many more of them. Now, 43 former Australian officials, including two former defense chiefs, an admiral, a general, four former heads of the Department of Foreign Affairs, three former intelligence agency chiefs, and a slew of former ambassadors, have stood forward in an open letter which they all signed to accuse the Howard government of multiple deceptions. At issue is the Howard government's participation in the assault and military occupation of Iraq, in which Australian troops were and are engaged with no end in sight. They said this: it is wrong and dangerous for elected representatives to mislead the Australian people. It's not surprising that Prime Minister Howard has walked right up to the starting line for a federal election at least three times, only to step back each time. Mr. Howard still has time. The last possible date for the coming federal election is April 16, 2005. Between now and then, there are six other possible election dates. While awaiting Mr. Howard's decision, it's always worthwhile to remember that the most dangerous politicians that any nation can have in power are those who think that politics as such is the art of deceiving the public, leaving them in power after it is clear that they are liars, is totally destructive of all mutual trust inside the nation. Distrust then flows from politics right through all other areas of life. In the end, such blanket mutual distrust becomes destructive. Now, in the Northern Hemisphere, the summer is grinding toward its end. Right now, Europeans and North Americans are on holiday. In Greece, the Olympics has hit its halfway point, with the games to close on Monday, August the 30th. Judging by the empty seats, wherever the Europeans et al. Have gone to get away from it all, it certainly hasn't been to Athens or to the Olympics. Meanwhile, on the day that the Olympics ends in Athens, the Republicans meet to anoint George Bush as their presidential candidate in the United States. New York City is gearing up for the Republican National Convention, which runs from August 30th to September the 2nd, with 20,000 police, Secret Service types, and the National Guardsmen lining up to face an expected 250,000 protesters. This year, Labor Day falls on Monday, September the 6th. Congress reconvenes from September the 7th until October the 1st. After that, they will all go home to get stuck in their real business, and that is getting reelected. And of course, after Labor Day, the presidential election campaign is on for young and old, with all of the gloves coming off. U.S. Secretary of the Treasury Snow has made it very clear to the U.S. Congress that he needs an increase in the debt ceiling. As already stated in this issue, the latest debt to the penny puts the debt within $41 billion of that ceiling. The more exact figure comes from the Treasury officials' debt subject to limit report. As of August the 19th, the debt subject to limit stood at $7.297 trillion, leaving a buffer of $87 billion to go to the present limit of $7.384 trillion. Now, if the United States Congress does not pass a debt limit increase in the three-week session, which begins on September the 7th, they will not have another chance to do so until after the November 2nd election. Even with the accounting smoke and mirrors pioneered by Secretary Rubin and refined by Secretary O'Neill, it is a moot point whether the Treasury can confine the debt subject to limit below the ceiling for that long. As also stated in this issue, it is the Republicans in both houses who will have to pass the legislation to raise the debt ceiling. They will not want to do that, much preferring to get the election out of the way first. And the question is, can they risk waiting until after the election? So far, this fiscal year, starting on October the 1st, 2003, the Treasury's debt subject to limit is up $559 billion. Now, that's a daily increase of $1.73 billion a day. Projecting that daily increase into the future and taking into account the $87 billion buffer between the debt as of August 19th and the ceiling, you get just 51 days till the ceiling is hit. 51 days from August the 19th brings us to October the 9th, 2004. Now, that's a 9-day, that's 9 days into the new U.S. fiscal year, 3+ weeks before the November 2nd elections, and at least a month, if not more, before any new Congress can reconvene. And Treasury Secretary Snow has already stated that even with the accounting practices used in previous similar episodes, he can keep the debt below the limit until mid-November at the very latest. Now, the stakes don't get much higher than this. It is a well-known fact that inside and especially outside of the United States that foreigners hold about half of all of the Treasury debt paper in private hands. And as of June 2004, their appetite showed no sign of flagging. In June, foreign purchases of U.S. financial assets totaled $71.8 billion, up from May's total of $65 billion. And according to the Ministry of Finance, the Japanese are no longer selling yen for dollars in order to hold the yen down against the dollar. But they certainly haven't lost their appetite for U.S. paper. In June, the Japanese bought a net $21.2 billion worth of said paper, up substantially from $15.7 billion that they bought in May. All right, we got to take a quick break. Hang on, we'll be back with more on the privateer and the international world economy when we return right after this. Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the Gordon Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement only. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the webpage, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule of archives, and it can be accessed through my webpage at georgegordon.org. Well, at the end of May 2004, the net foreign purchases of U.S. fixed interest assets, those are treasuries, for the year totaled $411 billion. Now, that's up 40% from the same period in 2003. As of the end of June 2004, Japan and China held $853 billion in U.S. treasuries between them. That's two nations, and they hold almost $1 trillion, about 1/7 of the total U.S. national debt. Now, the potential for surprises. It's about time, it is a time-honored practice in the United States for the administration, which is facing re-election, to pull off what has come to be known as an October surprise. The point of the exercise, of course, is to bring more voters over to their side of the ledger than the other party. For the ploy to succeed, the administration must surprise the voters, not the other way around. And above all, it is the administration which must do the surprising. And to have the surprise come from the American people or from foreigners is not a part of the playbook. So in this context, Iran is looming ever larger. For many weeks now, the Bush administration, high officials have been making ever more belligerent noises about Iran's nuclear capacity and its potential to be utilized in the secret production of nuclear weapons. Throughout the world, outside of the United States and in the Middle East in particular, this orchestrated barrage has a distinct odor of the process which prepared the American people for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Like the United Nations inspection teams in Iraq, the International Atomic Energy Agency, known as the IAEA, has been examining Iran's nuclear program. And like the United Nations inspection teams in Iraq with regard to weapons of mass destruction, the IAEA appears likely to announce that Iran's nuclear program does not include military elements when they report in September. Despite, or more likely because of this, the calls inside the United States for a preemptive strike are now getting louder and louder. Now, unfortunately for the Bush administration, the Iranian government is taking U.S. threats very seriously. On August the 18th, the Iranian defense minister openly warned the United States that if his military commanders believed that the United States was serious about attacking Iran, they would not wait for the U.S. to strike the first blow. And he also warned that any U.S. attack on Iran's nuclear power facility at Beshler would be taken as a casus belli for full-scale Iranian retaliation. When Iran talks of full-scale retaliation, they mean it, as witness the savagery of the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. On top of that, any ground attack on Iraq would leave an already severely overstretched U.S. military force in Iraq facing a determined enemy in front of them in Iran, while remaining in the midst of an equally determined enemy in Iraq. For the Bush administration to attack Iran now, given their siege position in Iraq and severely depleted nature of their conventional military arsenal and their notoriously weak global financial position, would be an act of lunacy. Clearer-thinking officials inside the Bush administration must know this. Certainly, many perceptive journalists and analysts, both inside and outside of the United States, know it, and they're saying so in no uncertain terms. Still, the rhetoric escalates, just as it did in the lead-up to the attack on Iraq in March of 2003. The great fear is that if the United States does attack, they will be entirely surrounded by hostiles in Iran and Iraq, with the very real prospect of having their supply lines cut by the comparatively simple sealing up of the Straits of Hormuz. Faced with such a situation, there's a real prospect that the United States might resort to tactical nuclear weapons. Such an act would indeed be a surprise, and more than a surprise, it would be a galvanizing shock to the world in general, and even more to the American people themselves. The revulsion would be intense, and the repercussions in every field, not least the financial arena, would be gigantic. The global economy is slowing down fast, and officials in both the Bush administration and at the Federal Reserve know this, and they're watching it with increasing dread. Over the past week, two nations, South Korea and South Africa, have taken the radical step of actually lowering their controlling interest rates in a desperate attempt to rekindle their stuttering growth. The global wherewithal to finance the burgeoning United States twin deficits is dwindling at the exact time when the United States administration is most vulnerable to economic and financial shocks of all descriptions. An economic financial crisis directly affecting or indeed occurring in the United States would not surprise United States officials, but it would surprise American voters. That's the fate which the Bush administration is desperate to avoid. How desperate are they? Well, desperate enough to threaten to attack Iran with a military ground force, which is already under siege in Iraq. The lunacy of this policy is the best measure possible, better than all statistics and economic indicators put together, of the Bush administration's estimation of the financial and economic position of the United States. The only better one would be a situation in which they actually do attack Iran. That would tear the lid off a global hornet's nest, which they probably cannot control. We're looking at the calm before the potential storms. And as this issue goes to press on August the 22nd, the only visible threats to U.S. financial equilibrium on the global markets are an oil price which is on the verge of reaching $50 a barrel and a gold price which has suddenly reawakened, halving the distance to its 2004 highs over the week of August the 16th through the 20th. U.S. stock markets are up this week, with the Dow regaining a measure of safety put back above the 10,000 level. Treasury yields of 5 years and longer maturity have hardly budged from their levels of a year ago, and the United States dollar index is in the bottom quarter of its 52-week trading range but remains well above its February 2004 lows. The last U.S. bubble, the real estate bubble, is still percolating, with median house prices having slowed their acceleration in the latest reporting period, but they are still rising. The longer that this surface equilibrium remains, the larger the potential for a financial surprise and the bigger the effect that surprise will have. Any sane administration facing re-election in the financial and geostrategic situation faced by the Bush administration would pull their horns in as far as humanly possible. Instead, the Bush administration seems intent on upsetting the global apple cart on all fronts. Both the privateer and you, our valued reader, can analyze and deduce the situation from the facts available to us. After all, they're all public and put out by the United States government agencies. But the Bush administration has access to far more facts than anyone else. Their evaluation of the present situation, as evidenced by their actions, and even more by their threats of future actions, is the real yardstick of how acute the international financial situation is. The United States government is in a position to know, and for once, the privateer is an advocate of taking this government financial analysis dead serious. In recent events, as the cost of living inexorably rises right around the world, it is becoming harder and harder to find any paper market which offers any genuine prospect of reasonable future profit. Bigger and bigger risks are being taken in order to keep profits at least in the black on financial markets. And so far in 2004, most global stock markets are in the red, and the rest of the paper markets offer anemic returns which are not proportional to the risk incurred. The appreciation of the risks being incurred are demonstrably rising, as witness the breakout of gold over the week of August the 16th through the 20th. And as we already pointed out online, see our link to gold this week, gold had a stellar week in terms not only of U.S. dollars but of all major world paper currencies. One ominous warning is contained in a report from the World Gold Council that Argentina bought 42 tons of gold in the first half of 2004 in order to lock its wealth into stable investments rather than bonds or equities. Argentina is the nation with the most recent experience with the consequences of unstable investments. Its entire financial and banking system melted down in late 2002 and early 2003. That's the danger that we're facing worldwide today. All right, we're reading from The Privateer. The Privateer is available from the publisher, William A. M. Buckler, Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, Australia 4567. Again, that's William A. M. Buckler, Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland 4567, Australia. The webpage, www.the-privateer.com. Again, that's www.the-privateer.com. There's a hyphen between the and privateer. The webpage, or the email rather, is capt@the-privateer.com. Again, that is capt@the-privateer.com. All right, and that's the story on the privateer. We got about 50 seconds here. Let me give you a reminder. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the Gordon Law School is a private, nonprofit, non-commercial, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement only. What that means is by contract or by invitation. We're not open to the public. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. All right, we got to take another break here. Hang on. We'll be right back with more right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. Surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits has produced greater efficiency and security, all right. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, the federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents, and every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, all of this information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how government, banking, insurance, business, and industry obtains all of this information? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for anyway? Well, knowing how information is gathered and what information is stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, for more information about privacy and privacy issues, why don't you call me here at the law school? It's 417-273-4967, and ask for my free general law CD package, and I'll tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call right now to order yours. The number 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website and send me an email. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me your email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Vermont will become the first state to sue the Federal Food and Drug Administration for rejecting a plan to import prescription drugs from Canada, the state's governor and attorney general said on Tuesday. Reacting to intense pressure to help make prescription drugs more affordable, Vermont officials had asked the drug agency in November to approve a pilot program under which the state would contract with a Canadian company that would take orders from Vermont residents and distribute the drugs by mail. On Monday, state officials received a letter from the drug agency denying that request, saying the government could not ensure the safety of drugs from Canada. Notice this is a safety issue. Could not ensure the safety of drugs from Canada. We'll come back to that. Other states, including Illinois, have received similar denials, but no other state has sued the FDA. The claims on which they've based this denial are, in our view, unsubstantiated, and we have no choice but to pursue any and all legal remedies available, said Governor Jim Douglas, a Republican, in a statement late Tuesday. Now, the state's Attorney General, William H. Sorrell, said Vermont's petition was carefully crafted and reasonable. I'm amazed that the FDA rejected it, but I'm looking forward to getting this in front of a federal judge. Now, states across the country have been trying to figure out ways to allow their citizens access to lower-priced Canadian drugs. 24 legislatures have passed or are considering bills to allow such programs, said Richard Cauchy. He's a health program director with the National Conference of State Legislatures. But while a few cities like Springfield, Massachusetts, Montgomery, Alabama, and Burlington, Vermont have started programs that import Canadian drugs, most state governments, faced with warnings from the FDA, are treading carefully. Minnesota, New Hampshire, North Dakota, and Wisconsin have set up websites that link consumers in their states with Canadian pharmacies so consumers can buy drugs on their own. New Hampshire's Governor Craig Benson, a Republican, said late last year that his state would import Canadian drugs for prison inmates, retired state employees, and Medicaid recipients, but the program has not yet begun. And Illinois Governor Rod R. Blagojevich, a Democrat who has projected that his state could save $91 million by buying Canadian drugs, has said he will not act without federal approval. In February, an Illinois couple filed a federal lawsuit against the drug agency and the Secretary of Health and Human Services, but Vermont, which expects to file its lawsuit within a week, will be the first state to take the federal government to court on the issue. Jason Gibbs, a spokesman, said Governor Douglas was determined to work within the system and within the limits of current law to implement a program. Vermont's proposal would have initially allowed the state to import Canadian drugs for current and retired state employees and their dependents, with a goal of expanding the plan to cover the Vermonters, Mr. Gibbs said. And he said that the pilot program was projected to save the state about 5% of the $18 million that it spends on prescriptions for state employees and retirees. Now, Mr. Gibbs said the Vermont proposal should have satisfied the safety issues because it's called specifically for the FDA to work with us to address safety concerns. But in denying Vermont's petition, William K. Hubbard, the agency's associate commissioner for policy and planning, wrote that it would be extremely unlikely that the state of Vermont could ensure that all of the Canadian drugs would be in full compliance with all of the laws and regulations applicable to FDA-approved drug products and were safe and effective. A spokeswoman for the drug agency, Kathleen Quinn, said it was a little premature for us to be commenting on a lawsuit that hasn't been filed yet, but as always, FDA is concerned about the safety of drugs coming into the United States. Mr. Gibbs said that while the lawsuit was pending, Vermont officials would meet with the New Hampshire officials and consider adopting that state's proposal to start importing Canadian drugs for some beneficiaries of state health care coverage. And in a letter Tuesday to the drug agency, Michael K. Smith, the Vermont Secretary of Administration, wrote that the state would be forced to consider development of reimportation program that conforms to our interpretation of the current laws independent of your agency. I'm going to come back here to the ensure the safety of drugs from Canada. Does anybody seriously believe that the Canadian companies that are dispensing these drugs are unsafe? No, the truth of the matter is it was the Congress of the United States in a conspiracy with the drug companies when they just enacted this drugs under Medicare for the elderly in the United States to specifically exclude importation of those drugs because in America the drug companies get double what they get in Canada. I had a druggist here come through school. He didn't know with specificity, but in about October I'm going to interview that druggist. He's getting some facts and figures. I think it'll blow your socks off. For instance, marijuana is sold in drugstores under a trade name. I forgot the name of it. But you can buy medical marijuana in capsule form right over the counter in your drugstore. Guess what it costs? 25 times more than you can buy a quarter baggie down on the street corner from your local drug salesman. I think that's really the motivation for keeping illegal drugs off the streets in the United States is because it interferes with competition with the legal drug firms like Pfizer and Merck and the licensed drug companies. But for these people to raise the issue of safety is disingenuous to say the least. In fact, the drugs that are being sold in Canada are licensed by these same drug companies to the drug companies in Canada. So, as Mark Twain says, there are liars, damn liars, and statistics, and in this case, the drug companies and the FDA in the United States are damn liars, pure and simple. And they specifically closed off buying those drugs from outside the United States so that they could force American consumers to pay double what they would pay in Canada, but get this, 10 times what they would pay in Mexico. Now, the drug companies, Merck and Pfizer and so on, when they make these drugs and sell them down in Mexico, are making two or three keystones. In other words, when they take a drug, they take a pill, for instance. They sell it in the United States for $35 a pill. And this druggist who was going through school pointed out that there are many drugs that are sold by the pill, and they cost $35 a pill, $5, $10, $15, $20 per capsule or pill. Same drug sells in Canada for half price, same drug sells in Mexico for one-tenth. A pill that sells for $35 in the United States will sell for $3.50 in Mexico, and it costs the drug company 10 or 15 cents to make. talk about obscene profits. Now, I'm not opposed to obscene profits, and I think that the drug company that can sell their profit, you know, one of my business principles is there's nothing wrong with making a good profit. But creating a monopoly and then saying that we can't buy our products anywhere else other than from you is pure monopoly. Government ought to protect us from monopoly, don't you think? Now, there's one last thing over here. America is a nation now of druggies. America is a nation of drug addicts. Our old people are receiving free drugs. Children receive shots and drugs from pediatricians. Our young people practice recreational drugs. So the young people are buying crack and cocaine down on the street corner. The children are being given Ritalin and other drugs and shots from their pediatricians. Our old people are receiving their drugs free through Medicare. America is a nation of drug addicts. That's the bottom line. Drugs, by the way, are the art of the apothecary. It's witchcraft and strictly prohibited in the scripture. We ought not to be taking drugs at all. We ought to be taking foods. Food is what cures disease by building your immune system. Drugs are fun. Drugs feel good. Drugs take away pains. But drugs are witchcraft. Hey, here's a little story. It's called cow tracking. And it's just me, or is it just me, or does anyone else find it absolutely amazing that the United States government can track a cow born in Canada almost 3 years ago right to the stall where she sleeps in the state of Washington, and then determine exactly what that cow ate? They can also track that cow's calves right to their stalls, and they can tell you what kind of feed those calves ate. But they're totally unable to locate 11 million illegal aliens wandering around in our country, including people that are trying to blow up important buildings. You know, my solution is give every illegal alien a cow as soon as they enter the country. Then we could keep track of them. There's a little story on diversion. I don't know if I've got enough time here to deliver it all, but diversion. It's called the Daily Diversion, How Rising Rates Are Affecting You. The Federal Reserve has begun raising rates, that's interest rates, for the first time since 2000. And it's expected to continue raising these rates well into 2005. Here are some of the ways that the Federal Reserve's action will affect ordinary consumers and businesses. In housing, rates on long-term fixed-rate mortgages already have jumped nearly 1 point in the past 3 months and are likely to rise another half point by the end of 2004. Industry experts tell us that adjustable-rate mortgages will be rising, meaning high monthly payments for many homeowners. Now, you should keep in mind that 75% of all of the homes in America have been refinanced over the last 3 years. That's right, refinanced. That's what's been fueling, at least in part, the expansion of our economy. What it means, in real terms, is that Americans own less and less equity in their homes. They have taken the equity out of their homes, and they have spent it on consumer goods like automobiles and other things. Do you really think that's very intelligent, very wise? Hang on, we've got to take a break here. We'll be back with more right after this. Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, and negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights, and permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small business being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, and your property from these incessant attacks by OSHA, the EPA, the State Tax Commission, zoning and planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies who are eating out your substance? Well, there's a lot that you can do, and the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package and let me tell you more about what it is you're not supposed to know about private business. It's educational, entertaining, informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order your copy right now. The number is 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to my webpage, georgegordon.org. Click on the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, talking about housing, autos, credit cards, and interest rates, zero interest rate loans will become a more expensive incentive for automakers, although they probably will continue to be offered on selected models for now. Over time, this free money is likely to disappear, said David Weiss. He's the chief economist at Standard & Poor's. What do you think of the marketplace when they have to pay you $1,000, $2,000, $3,000? I just saw one the other day. $4,000 cash back if you buy a car and interest-free. That tells me the marketplace is pretty soft, but you know they're not giving you anything. They'll give you, for instance, a carpet store in Springfield will put carpet in your house, no payments, no interest, for a year. But when the payments do begin, they've got a lien against your house for the amount of the carpet. Now remember, that's a bank that's putting that money up, and it's your United States government that's trying to loan, trying to get that money out into circulation to stimulate the economy. And they're stimulating the economy by burying you in debt. When this economy collapses, you will lose your job and be unable to pay that debt. You'll get foreclosed on, and there will be a massive turnover of the real property in America, real and personal and chattel property. I suspect, though, that when the chips come down, that the government and the banks will come to you and say, if you will put this chip in your right hand and in your forehead, we will not foreclose upon your house, we will not foreclose upon your car, and we will give you credits in the bank, and you can continue on with your business just like you have in the past. Let's see if I'm a prophet in my own time. Credit cards, the rates already are on average 13% on credit card balances and likely will head higher over the next 2 years. Weiss of Standard & Poor's estimated that credit card rates will rise about 1.5 percentage points, assuming the Fed ultimately raises its benchmark rate by about 3 points over that time frame. Home equity and other loans, many home equity and business loans are tied to banks' prime rate, which will move up in lockstep with the Fed's benchmarks. That means higher monthly payments for existing loans. Businesses might choose not to borrow to fund certain marginal projects. Okay, and you're going to be strapped more and more because as your payments go up on your credit card interest and your payments, you know, Walmart is estimating that the rise in the price of gasoline has taken $7 out of the average customer's budget to spend in Walmart. All right, now the inflation is headed up. And now as interest rates go up, you'll have to spend more money on your credit card payments, and you'll have less money to spend in Walmart because you're spending it on higher priced gas and more money on interest rates. The less money that we spend out in the marketplace, then the less the economy grows. As the economy grows less, you know, it begins to look like to me that we've got a self-perpetuating death pill here, don't we? Going on, they say home equity and other loans, many home equity and business loans, are tied to banks' prime rates, which will move up in lockstep with the Fed's benchmarks. So not only are the credit cards going up, autos going up, housing going up, your home equity and other loans are going up, now deposits. As interest rates rise, cash will be king, bringing relief to senior citizens and other investors who have suffered for years with low interest payments on their savings. Banks and brokerages gradually will pay more on savings, money market accounts, and certificates of deposit. And at the very same time all of this is going on, inflation is growing at the rate of 7% per year. So, as inflation grows by 7% and as the interest on your savings and investments edge up to 2, 3, 4%, you will be losing double that to inflation. How does that equate with a higher standard of living, boys and girls? Then we've got foreign exchange. Higher U.S. interest rates tend to strengthen the dollar, making imports cheaper and making American-made products more expensive overseas. The dollar has risen about 3% on a trade-weighted basis so far this year. Weiss of Standard & Poor's predicted the dollar would remain steady as the Fed raises rates and then fall under pressure from the nation's huge trade deficit. Now, I reported to you on that huge trade deficit running about $550 billion a year. It's so astronomical and so absolutely necessary and imperative to our economy that it's a phenomenon of and by itself, never before in my lifetime, and I doubt if it's ever occurred in history. Our economy is fueled by these imports. Yet, we can't pay for these imports, so we have to borrow the money from the companies and the countries that are exporting, and then we're buying their products. China and Japan are fueling this expansion in our economy. Isn't that just special? And why is the mortgage for 30 years? Well, to earn enough money to purchase a house, Americans had to work an average of 1,125 days back in 1962. By 1972, 10 years later, it had grown to 1,330 days. By 1982, it was 1,530 days. And by 1992, it was 1,777 days to work for and to pay off that 30-year mortgage. The real standard of living in America is not going up. It has been going down since 1973. Yes, it's true, computers are cheaper, telephone rates are cheaper, and gasoline is actually cheaper, adjusted for inflation, than it was in 1954, 55, 56. However, when we take a look at the whole market basket of supplies, goods, and services that we buy, we have not received a rate increase or a pay increase since 1973, and now your wife has to work in order to support the family. It takes two wage earners today. Now, restitution for black farmers. Listen to this. The New York Times editorial of July 27, 2004 reports that in 1999, African American farmers won a major civil rights settlement against the United States Department of Agriculture. They had argued that the loans and subsidies that they received were substantially lower than those for comparable white farmers. What made matters worse was the fact that Reagan-era budget cuts closed the USDA Civil Rights Office for 13 years. So most of the complaints filed during that time were never heard. But to its credit, the Department of Agriculture conducted an internal investigation and discovered that racial discrimination had not only occurred, but had also been structurally and historically embedded in its operations for decades. What looked like a good settlement promising prompt payment to black farmers now looks like a total failure. That's according to a new investigation by the Environmental Working Group, an advocacy group. Again and again, these farmers have run up against procedural hurdles that have effectively blocked most of them from receiving payments that were supposed to be automatic. Because of poor record keeping, the USDA seriously underestimated the number of farmers who had been discriminated against. It also did a terrible job of seeking out farmers who might qualify for payments, and it did absolutely nothing to help them get the documents needed to demonstrate the loan and subsidy support that neighboring white farmers had received, even though the USDA had the records. They never made them available to black farmers. Now, this is discrimination by a different name, a continuation, in effect, of the racism historically entrenched in the USDA. The department's resistance and the inherent inadequacies in the original settlement have caused a staggering rate of farm failures among small-scale black farmers, three times the rate for white farmers. That has sped up the loss of farmland to development. That has sped up the loss of the farmland to developers who are developing this farmland for subdivisions or for other uses. And in the past few decades, the United States Department of Agriculture has paid only lip service to the survival of small farms, and it apparently pays only lip service to civil rights as well. The remedy for this inequity will not be found at the department. Carrying out the settlement with fairness and accountability will require the intervention of Congress. Well, let me point out that the policy of the USDA since 1900 has been to drive the small farmers off the land and to turn that land over to the multinational corporations. Now, the black farmers were actually better off in 1900 than they are today. There not only was more of them, they were getting paid better, and they were making a better living. Now, to add insult to injury, the USDA has hired a battery of attorneys, and these attorneys are working to block the payments to the black farmers who won the class action suit. They actually paid the lawyers more than they could have settled the cases for with the black farmers. Now, this isn't something that's endemic just to the Bush administration. It's something that's been going on in this country for at least 100 years. Remember, the objective is the New World Order. The objective is to drive every farmer off the land and to turn that land over to the multinational corporations controlled by government. It's to destroy private property under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. The Department of Agriculture is simply doing their part to accomplish that goal. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and it can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All right, we're out of time. That's the signal. Says my time is up. I've got to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.